Okay, welcome back to House Finance. It's Friday morning, April 29th, 8:45. For the record, we have Representative Moses, Representative Kelly, Representative Foster, Representative Hocker, Representative Jewell, and then myself, Co-Chairman Meyer. We have Representative Holm with us. Saul, Co-Chairman Schnopf, but he's here, but not really current. Okay, this morning, what we'd like to do is take up House Bill 272, card rooms, and also the House Bill 217, and HCR 6, extending the Infrastructure Policy Task Force. So, is there anything to come before the committee?
Thank you very much.
Should we take up 141? Yeah. If not, then let's go get go right into House Bill 272.
You're looking for a motion to table 141?
don't go there. Okay. For the record, if you can tell us who you are, Mr. O'Hare, and your affiliated with, and tell us about your bill. Thanks, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning. My name is Michael O'Hare, staff for Representative Pete Cott. And before you this morning is HB 272, an act relating to card rooms and card room operations. And there's a CS offered before you, which I'll give a brief description of the bill, sir. The growing popularity of poker is obvious to everyone who has surfed the TV channels. Many networks, from ESPN to the Travel Channel, are regularly televising Texas Hold'em tournaments, enjoying skyrocketing popularity and revenues.
Mr. Sir, you could just say, looks like we have a new CS here that we really should adopt and get that for us and let you explain those changes. Co-Chairman Schnell?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I move that we make a motion to accept CS for House Bill 272, it'd be 24/LS0916/F.
Okay, any objections? Say none? Okay, we have CS before us. Continue, sir. Sorry.
Sorry.
Also, for the record, Representative Wire.
Mr. Chairman, poker playing is one of the fastest growing forms of entertainment today. Men and women, old and young, from all walks of life are joining the poker trend, which shows no sign of slowing down. Due to this growth in interest, the intent of HB 272 is to allow social card games to be played in a tightly controlled public environment. Alaska can address the trend and bring this popular pastime into compliance with the safety and revenue laws of the state. The games in question that being allowed to play are non-banking card games, which means card games where players play against one another, as opposed to bank games that the house pays the winners and takes money from the losers, like blackjack and roulette. The games are played for tokens or chips, not negotiable currency. And the games are poker, pan, rummy, bridge, and cribbage. Excuse me. There's a limited number of licenses for card room operations, and they would be only for municipalities of 30,000 people or more, and may not exceed the total population divided by 30,000 people. The licensee is required to pay a non-refundable application fee of $25,000 with the Department of Revenue, post a $500,000 cash bond, pay an annual fee of $10,000 for each card table, and they must be fingerprinted, of course have background checks, pay for all investigative costs incurred over the initial $25,000 application fee, and they're required to host quarterly tournaments with the gross proceeds to be distributed to nonprofit educational institutions or groups designated by the owner. The license is good for 5 years and can only be renewed by a municipal vote of the people after.
Did you see my finger?
they like that.
On good terms here. An individual cannot get a license if convicted of a felony, knowingly falsify their application, are currently a manager, owner, director, or managerial employee of an existing operation, employer of an owner, director, or managerial employee of an existing operation. HB 272 allows for the Department of Revenue to strictly enforce regulations imposed on cardroom operations while allowing card players to enjoy a safe, regulated playing environment for their favorite pastime. It also gives back to the community by creating decent-paying jobs and supporting nonprofit educational charities, as well as removing at least 75% of the so-called after-hours card rooms. An idea of how many jobs it might create would be based on an average of four jobs per card table. Card room operation with 150 tables is about approximately 600 jobs. Those types of employees might be dealers, cash people, security folks, auditors, chip runners, management, etc. There is a fiscal note as well as a sectional analysis and legal opinion with regards to the effect of this bill with regards to Indian gaming. There's also enclosed, I believe, a spreadsheet giving an example of possible gross sales and employee information. That concludes my introduction. I know we have some people online to testify. I'm good for questions.
Thank you, Mr. O'Hara. Any questions? Representative Holm.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. It just occurred to me when I saw Bridge, why not Pinochle? Pinochle is a very well played, I mean, it's a very played a lot.
That's correct.
And I just wondered why Bridge would be there and Pinochle wouldn't be there, because they're both very similar game. People that play Pinochle used to play Bridge and vice versa.
Through the chair, Representative Holm, I believe it's the intent of the sponsor to include Pinochle as well. So, excuse me.
Does the sponsor want to join us? So we don't have to talk for
love
you.
Love to join you, Pinochle. Having not played Pinochle for a number of years.
For the record, Representative.
For the record, Representative Peacock, District 17. I'd be more than happy to entertain Pinochle. I'm just not sure how it fits in. I'm not really social card player to that extent, but if it works, I don't see any reason why it couldn't fit in with the bill.
Is that an amendment you'd like to make later, Representative?
I think so, yeah.
Okay. You can ponder that a little bit. Any other
questions? As long as it falls, Mr. Chairman, as long as it falls into the non-bank.
It's a non-bank. It would be a non-bank.
And that would be fine. I mean, this offers another opportunity for those players that might want to participate in Pinochle, whatever that is.
We can have a discussion later.
You may want to teach him Pinochle.
For a nominal fee.
Richard Hawker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just handed a fresh fiscal note. My question was drafted in the previous one. I think it looks like I made it fixed. I will say the earlier fiscal note indicated the census basis was uncertain in the bill. Did that get straightened out?
That did get straightened out.
That's all it takes. Thank you, sir.
Any other questions for the sponsor, Representative Robert?
We're going to have public testimony, I assume. And then
that's great.
Can they come back? I have some questions about some language in the bill.
Sure.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah. You can stay for a while. Okay. All right, then let's go right into the public testimony. Thank you. Let's see. I have on the list here Ethan Billings here in Juneau. Ethan.
Well, welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you for the opportunity today. My name is Ethan Billings, and I've been an Alaska resident for 31 years, and I'm the owner-operator of two Juneau businesses, Marlantini's Lounge in the Airport Shopping Center, as well as Doc Waters Pub down on the Merchant's Wharf. I've been an active member of the Alaska Char for over 10 years, and I'm current vice president of the Lynn Canal Char Association. I'm here today to support House Bill 272. I just got back from Anchorage on Wednesday, and let me tell you, Texas Hold'em is spreading like wildfire up there in Anchorage, as well as Wasilla and Fairbanks. I believe this bill is past due and necessary to regulate the card playing fever that's going on in Alaska right now, as well as around the nation. Card games are entertainment, and more entertainment is needed in the state, not only for the locals, but as well as for tourists who visit the state. If this bill passes, I would also recommend that the current legal card games that are being played at local bars be allowed to continue. Most of those tournaments are played for charity organizations, as well as it also helps the small businesses that are currently running the card games. In closing, I just ask for you to pass House Bill 272, and that's all I have to say today.
Okay. Thank you. Ethan, by the way, I ate at your restaurant just last week. It's very good.
Great. Yeah. It's better when the weather's nice, too.
Yes.
Great.
Okay, any questions? Say none. Thank you very much, Ethan.
Thank you.
Chip Wagner. There's Chip.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Chip Wagner. I'm with the Alaska Catholic Conference. I'm their executive director. It's the official public policy voice of the Catholic Church in Alaska. The bill before you represents a sea change in state policy as it relates to gambling. It takes the state from the charitable gaming into a commercial gaming enterprises known as card rooms, which will be operated by the professional gaming industry. It will add to, but it will not replace, the illegal gambling or internet gambling already occurring. There's been absolutely no evidence or research shown to this or any other committee of the legislature that passing this bill will lead to less crime or less illegal gambling in Alaska. Rather, as will be shown, it will lead to more crime. At the last committee of referral, we did not say that we opposed this bill. We expressed our concern and asked that the committee look at the effects that the bill would have on people and the effects that gambling would have on people. They chose not to and referred the bill to this committee. We, however, did look at the effects, and our concern has now changed to outright opposition. We are opposed to this bill for two main reasons. First, and most importantly, some Alaskans will be hurt and hurt badly by this bill. And second, and this is very important to this committee, the state does not have the money that it will be willing to spend to fund the necessary programs to deal with all of the problems that will flow out of the expansion of legalized gambling in this state. Now, why will it hurt some Alaskans? It will, because gambling can be an addiction, and some Alaskans will become addicted to gambling. Now, a card room in and of itself does not cause a gambling addiction any more than a liquor store on a street corner causes an alcohol addiction. But both add fuel to the fire for those who do have a susceptibility for becoming addicted. Now, the American Psychiatric Association classifies pathological gambling as an impulse control disorder and describes 10 criteria to guide diagnoses, from the repeated unsuccessful efforts to control, cut back, or stop gambling, to committing illegal acts such as forgery, fraud, theft, or embezzlement to finance gambling. The 10 criteria represent three dimensions: damage or disruption, loss of control, and dependence. I might add here that it's not really a financial problem. Gambling is an emotional problem. It's an emotional disorder. And all agree, and I'm reading from the National Commission on the Impact of Gambling, which is the most comprehensive study ever done in this country or world about gambling in this nation. And they said that all seem to agree that pathological gamblers engage in destructive behaviors. They commit crimes, they run up large debts, they damage relationships with family and friends, and they kill themselves. The increased availability of gambling, such as the bill before you, and new gambling technologies, pathological gambling has the potential to become even more widespread. Now, there's another category of gambling called problem gamblers, and that's where they meet less than 5 of the criteria for pathological gamblers. Now, the National Research Council of the National Academy of Sciences reviewed over 4,000 references on the literature on pathological and problem gambling, and they concluded that if you look at just the past 12 months for these individuals, that about 1% of gamblers will be pathological gamblers, and another 2% will be problem gamblers. So 3% of those that will be gambling will cause some societal problems and some costs to the state. These figures are much higher if you look at lifetime rates for gamblers. Additionally, the National Research Council found that 3% and 7% of those who gambled in the past year reported some symptoms of problem or pathological gambling. In other words, they had some of the symptoms, but not enough to rise to the level of being a problem gambler or a pathological gambler. Now, as I said, the major study in this country was the one that was commissioned by Congress, and that was the National Gambling Impact Study Commission. And they stated in their final report that even though additional research needed to be done, that the commission, which included industry representatives, the commission is unanimous in its belief that the incidence of problem and pathological gambling is of sufficient severity to warrant immediate and enhanced attention on the part of public officials and others in the private and nonprofit sectors. The commission strongly urges those in positions of responsibility to move aggressively to reduce the occurrence of this malady in the general population and to alleviate the suffering of those afflicted. Now, will this bill before you increase gambling addictions in Alaska? The answer is yes. And we have not testified on this before because we weren't sure. We weren't sure if card rooms could be addictive. We now are of the opinion that they can be. The National Opinion Research Center at the University of Chicago found that the presence of a gambling facility within 50 miles roughly doubles the prevalence of problem and pathological gambling in the area. Similarly, the National Research Council of the National Academy of Sciences concluded that some of the greatest increases in the number of problem and pathological gamblers shown in these repeated surveys came over periods of expanded gambling opportunities in the state study. So if you want to increase pathological gambling, problem gambling, then you want to pass this bill. And I can refer to somebody whose, this is not his real name, his name is Phil. He left a blackjack table, and this bill is, does not have blackjack in it. That'll be coming down the road, I'm sure. After having a losing couple of hands there, he went straight for the Aurora Bridge with the intention of jumping off. He didn't, and which is why we know about the story. He was a successful public relations consultant. He saw his marriage crumble, his rising career shattered, his relations with his large and loving family deeply strained. As legalized gambling continued to grow and make a swift rise in Washington state, so also did the parallel yet more quiet growth of problem gambling marched right along with it with disastrous consequences. Problem and pathological gamblers have hurt themselves and others through increased indebtedness and bankruptcies, crime, divorce, and in the worst cases, suicide. Those troubles cost Washington state millions of dollars a year. Worse, thousands of lives were ruined. The societal costs of problem gambling are significant. In Washington state, again, bankruptcy lawyers said they're seeing more filings than ever caused by gambling troubles. Seattle lawyer Kevin Hanchett said gambling debt is now a factor in 15 to 20% of the 100 plus consumer cases he handles. Sometimes it's the only factor. He said there's been a definite increase over the years, and 10 years ago, it was virtually non-existent. The trend was non-existent about gambling and bankruptcy. That trend now is very active down there in Washington. Similarly, King County Prosecutor Nora Malik has said that his deputies regularly see the effects of problem gambling in the cases they prosecute. And where do they see it? It plays out in increased instances of domestic violence and child neglect. Now, the Illinois Institute for the Addiction Recovery noted that pathological gambling is a hidden disease. You don't see anyone stumbling down the street. You don't see needle marks. You can't tell if I'm a pathological gambler or not. It's hidden. Secondly, it's also an ununderstood disease. People now feel alcoholism is a disease. They do not look at gambling addiction as a disease. Most people have never even thought about it. And yet, Charles Maher, a Seattle psychologist, who is immediate past president of the National Council on Problem Gambling, which, by the way, is an organization that is neither for or against gambling, their main concern is taking care of those that have the addiction. They said that alcoholics and cocaine-dependent males are telling me the hook of the gambling addiction is deeper. In other words, if you have a cocaine habit, it's easier to overcome that cocaine habit than it is a gambling habit.
Chip, I'm going to have to ask you to wrap up your...
I have just about one more minute. Okay. Thank you. The second reason deals with costs. The National Commission determined that problem gamblers will cost society $750 each year, and pathological gamblers will cost society $1,200 each year. Oregon, for example, which has a pretty extensive gambling now, has had to fund 27 treatment centers and hired more than 50 counselors certified to treat problem gamblers. More than 10,000 people have entered state treatment programs since 1995. They're spending, just on treatment, about $4.5 million is my understanding. Worse, I don't think there's a single certified treatment counselor, gambling treatment counselor in the state of Alaska. I couldn't find one on any of the websites. Now, the economic benefits to the state government from this bill will not come close to funding treatment of addicted gamblers, to say nothing about ruined careers, destroyed families, increased crime, more suicides, and more domestic violence and child neglect. Even if this industry paid for itself, we should not look at its economic growth potential as a good thing if our brothers, even though they may be a smaller number of us, a small percentage, are hurt. This bill will hurt some Alaskans, and we urge you not to pass it out of this committee. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Okay, another question, Representative
Chenault. Yeah, Chip, I was just curious. You quoted a couple of these studies, and do those studies deal with gambling in general? Is that just card room gambling, or is this are the studies that you're speaking to as far as the addiction to gambling, is that to slot machines and roulette and poker, and is that all up, or is that a specific study dealing with just card rooms?
The National Commission study, the main study, the proper name is National Gambling Impact Study Commission Report, dealt with all forms of gambling. And it's an excellent question, Representative, because some types of gambling are more addictive than others. Electronic video games are more addictive than card room games. Card room games are more addictive than raffles, which I don't think are addictive at all. What I found in my research of this is the speed of the game is one indicator of making it more addictive than less addictive. So the faster the game, the more addictive it is. My research has also shown that those who are more likely to become addictive are the young, because the young, you know, speed is important. You know, they want the fast computer. Everything's got to be now. The instant gratification, that type of thinking leads to more addictions. So speed is a big, big factor. Card games, if you watch them on television, are pretty fast games, and they move like that.
I'm not going to argue with you, but I've watched it on TV.
I have too.
It's pretty slow. It's pretty slow compared to video poker machines or other machines that I've seen in gambling places that I've.
No question. There's a difference, but it still leads to the same effect.
Okay.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Wagner.
Thank you.
We do have a gentleman online here, Robert Hall.
Hello, Honorable Chairman, members of the committee. Can you hear me?
I'm
Robert Hall from Houston, Alaska. I enjoy playing poker, especially poker tournaments, and I've played them throughout the United States for the last 10 years. And I strongly support the concept of legalized card rooms in Alaska, but I have several concerns. And I don't want to diminish the comments of Mr. Wagner. What you do here is a big deal, and it should be done very carefully. My first concern is from the approach of, from the player's perspective, that and the impact it'll have throughout on other businesses throughout the area, especially up here in the Mat-Su. It's going to limit the number of card rooms to two. And if you live in Willow or Talkeetna or something like that, you have to drive 50 miles or 40 miles down to Wasilla to play. Anchorage will have 10 casinos or 10 card rooms with unlimited number of card tables. They may have end up with a card table for every 3,000 or 4,000 people. But, I would support the idea that if you tweak this bill in the next committee to allow fraternal organizations to have one table, maybe reduce the financial requirements so that an Elks Club or Veterans of Foreign War could have one table that wasn't so expensive. It would reduce the that they have to charge the players. If you don't charge players too much, the money just circulates around in a big circle. But if you have big card rooms, then they're going to have to charge a lot, and that's where the money is going to be sucked out and head to the large organizations. I'd also support the idea of maybe allowing bars to have maybe one table, and I'm president of the Houston Lions Club. I'd like to be able to occasionally sponsor our own poker tournament, and if you could tweak the laws to allow nonprofits to have tournaments, that would be good. The advisory board, apparently in this bill doesn't allow to have any per diem or expenses covered for travel, and the advisory board's going to be pretty important. There's a lot of decisions that come down. I hate to limit the participation on that board. You know, if we're going to ask them to spend their time and give them their per diem. Just the games, I'd add backgammon to that. Reduce the bonding requirement from $500,000 down to $100,000. There's going to be few Alaskans that are going to participate in card rooms, and you're going to end up with a lot of outside large corporations. The list of requirements of who should get the permitting. I have some sort of thing to look at the commitment that the individual has to Alaska and the ability of them to be a good, qualified owner. And put some more Alaskan ownership into this and reduce some of the financial bonding requirements. Support the idea. It's something you have to do very cautiously, but it's happening anyway. It's better to have good, solid controls. Outside of Anchorage, if you live in Cordova or Valdez or something and you want to go play, you may have enough players for a table or two, but you may not meet the 30,000 limit. So I don't really think, if you're in Anchorage, you know, everything seems to be centered around Lost Anchorage, and it seems that the Willow or Talkeetna area should at least be able to have one table, even though they may not have 30,000 people. Not much.
Okay. Thank you for your testimony. Seeing no questions.
There apparently is another person out in the valley, William Barr.
Hi, this is William Farr from Houston, Alaska. I've been a resident in Houston for 15 years, and I would really support legalized gambling in Houston. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Okay, is there anyone else who wanted to testify on this? House Bill 272. Showing no one else here or online, we'll go ahead and close public testimony.
The sponsor wants to join us at the table again, please.
Representative Wyra, did you have some questions for the sponsor? Sponsor Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Should implementation of this in a municipality that's limited to 30,000 or more people, should that be subject to a vote of the municipality in which a card room is proposed? That was something that came up last year, I think, on the casino.
Well, it's certainly a policy call, Mr. Chair, Representative Wyra. It's a policy call that certainly this committee has the project to make. My thought is to allow these card rooms to gain momentum, to be put into place, and then by a vote of the people, if it is so objectionable, if there's the social ill wills that are tailing the card room, then the municipality or the boroughs can then curtail those operations. I don't think that would be the case, but certainly I'd like to see the card rooms put into place, and then if there is problems after the fact, then you can deal with them.
Okay.
The on page two, there's going to be wagering. If a card room sells tokens or chips, those are subject to the sales tax at that point. If there's a local sales tax, is that right? Is that how it would work?
Now that, from the chair, Representative Weirach, I think that'd be a question for the department. I'm not so sure that
right.
You can put a sales tax on the exchange of currency. I mean, that's basically with chips. And poker chips, I mean, you'd be have the same value as a dollar as currency. Now, I'm not sure you can actually put a sales tax on that.
Representative Warwick, I should have mentioned, Larry Myers with the tax division is online, as well as Brett Freed, economist with the tax division, Department of Revenue is online.
Let me go through these and then we'll
The
chips can be purchased by means of an agreement in which the licensed owner extends credit to the patron. That one has, some folks have expressed concern to me because of the potential for usurious credit charges. If somebody gets into it, gee, they want to do more and more, the interest rate goes higher, higher, depending on how much you want. And there was no, by giving an extension, I can see credit card, you mean buying my credit card is one thing, but extending credit, you can see that opens up an issue. I don't know if you had any thought on that, I just had a question about that.
Mr. Chair, a lot of what is in the bill is basically very broad, and it will be then controlled by the board, if you will, right. Five members that are appointed. And they'll be the ones that are basically come up with the rules and regulations on how to operate as far as extending credit. That may be using a credit card. You can purchase chips. I can't, in my mind, fathom the idea that I'm going to walk in there and whoever the owner is, will you give me credit until I can come back and pay you? I mean, I don't think that's what they're after here.
All right. And then it talks about investigating and reinvestigating. Just your intent there is to allow them that reinvestigation. I'm looking at page 3, number 4. You can investigate applicants, but that reinvestigate, which is something I haven't seen much in statute, allows them to just any time go in and reinvestigate if they want to, if the department goes in to reinvestigate. Is that your intent there?
That's the intent. And we want to make sure that the operations, if there's any indication that something is going on that shouldn't be going on, we want to give the authority to the department to investigate these people, to go back and reinvestigate,
right.
And they have to reinvestigate again.
Okay. Then on page 4, you're talking about violations and fee inspections, where the department can enter into the card room to evidence if there's noncompliance. Does that allow the department to go in without a warrant?
That would allow the department to go in without a warrant.
Okay, so they can go in there and search anything if they...
We've given, in this bill, the department almost sole authority under any suspicion to enter a card room.
Okay.
We want this as absolutely clean as possible.
Okay. I just had some other amendments I was going to talk to him about the sponsor and then bring it back to the committee. They're minor, but I think you should check.
Okay. Representative Hawkins.
Thank you, Chairman. Listening to the folks testifying at the same question, this $30,000, the one card room for 30,000 population really does restrict this to a couple of locations, or population centers of the state. If you put thought of the consequences or getting thoughts on, say, going to like 15,000 people, and something that comes to my mind is that we give every 15,000 people in the state one House representative, that seems to be ample enough. I'm wondering if 15,000 might be a fair.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hawker, the 30,000 number was an arbitrary number. We tried to determine what kind of population base would support a card room, and we used a set number of card tables. in order for that card room to be profitable, and I believe managed appropriately, you'd have to have a certain level of population to support it. And 30,000 was an arbitrary number in,
it seems like it was
in supporting a card room of about 15 tables. And you got to recognize that for these operations to be successful, and that's one of the requisites in the bill in order to get the license, that you know, the licensee, potential licensee, has to show that this is going to continue for the 5 years and not just start up and fold. You got to have a population base that's out there to support this. And those tables, depending on how many they establish, whether it's 10 or 15 or 5, in my mind, you're going to have about 80% of those tables fully occupied in order for that operation to be successful. So we want to do this on a more limited basis. I mean, we could have said no population base. You know, that could have been taken out of the bill. But we wanted to put this into a trial basis with a population of 30,000. And obviously, if it works, then at some later date, this legislature can come in there and tweak the laws and expand it to smaller locations. But obviously, it's a policy call. We did a little bit of homework on this and tried to figure out what the population would need to be in order for this facility to be successful.
You know, I guess where I'm also going with that is the concept underlying this is that these are professionally managed, somewhat substantial. There's a substantial establishment, professionally managed, highly regulated. We're really not trying to open the door here on, you know, single tables in the back room of a bar. We're really looking at it. We're trying to maintain a requirement level of professionalism, and I guess that's kind of what we're going to limit this to, the 30,000 rather than some issues that perhaps have no limits.
Through Chair, Mr. Hawker, absolutely. That's what the intent is here. In fact, I understand there's been a few calls into this building since this bill was introduced. There was some concerns, and those concerns have come from people who operate the underground tables, if you believe that. In my mind, you'll see about 75%. You won't get rid of all of them. I mean, it's not going to happen, but in my mind, you're going to see about a 75% reduction in what's ongoing in Anchorage right now. That's illegal. Those players will then rise to the surface and become legal players if this bill were to become law.
Thank you. Okay,
sure. Peanut player.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Cott, on page 9, you have a line 14. It says, a person applying for an owner's license under this chapter shall pay a non-refundable $25,000 fee. The question is, let's say you take Cartlands, for example. You have 90,000 people would justify 3 licenses. And you have 20 people apply for those 3 licenses. What provision in the bill here gives the money back? You say it's non-refundable, gives the money back to the 17 losers.
Obviously, Mr. Chairman, through the Chair, Representative Holm, if in fact there were 3 licensees in existence in Fairbanks, using your example, and somebody applied for a 4th, number one, they probably have done their homework because they recognize that the numbers have already been reached as far as the number of licensees in that facility. But I would assume in this particular case that the board that would regulate the card rooms, that input policy group would establish, and I think even if you ask the Department of Revenue what would happen if somebody submitted a license, $25,000 fee for a license that we can't issue because we're not under law, we can't they would return that. I mean, that I think would be just common sense. That obviously you could write that into the bill if you wanted, but I mean that's a common sense approach. If you've already got three licensees in the location which you can operate these card rooms, fourth person comes in.
No, I think I understand it, Richard. I guess what I was asking was, I don't see a process here by that you're going to choose. Who's going to choose which one becomes the successful bidder? So, for example, I mean, if this became law, I don't imagine you're going to have 100 people apply, but I would imagine you might have, if you only have three places, you certainly would have more people than three that would apply. My guess would be. And if they apply, what procedures do we have to give back the money to the ones that aren't successful, that's all? Because apparently the board is going to make the choice as to who's going to be a successful bidder. Is that correct?
Well, the board, Chair, what I would anticipate happening is the board will draft up the policies regarding the applications of the licenses. And I suspect that what's going to happen is because there is not a deadline like on a bid where you got three bidders and you got a deadline to get it in, it's a low bidder. In this particular case, I'm guessing what's going to happen, and the department can enter into the conversation here, but guessing what's going to happen, it's going to be first in. Is based on, you know, because there's no deadline, I mean, there may only be one applicant in Fairbanks. For if this bill were passed, there may only be one applicant for the first month. And then somebody else enters the fray, so you got your second one, then you got four applicants during that next week period. But I think what you have to recognize is it's those that have taken the initiative and got their applications in first would have to be given that first look, because there's not a closing date. So I mean, you have to establish some kind of a timeline to review these applications. And if that third applicant is now the third applicant, and I came in as a third applicant in Fairbanks at 2 o'clock, and there was three people at 2:30 that came in after me and filed, I think they would have to look at my application first. You have to, and again, that's really what we've established this board for, is to help develop those procedures on how to return the license application fees. And obviously, if I came in at 2:30 and that license is no longer available, they would have to return the $25,000.
Well, I appreciate that. Mr. Chairman, if I could just follow up just one little piece here on this. In essence, this is kind of where my problem is with this kind of a scenario, and that is what you're developing here is a first-come, first-served basis, and I think I understand that. The problem is it's like the value of a liquor license or the value of a limited entry for fishing when you go down the beach and stuff. So it has value that's much greater than the value that the state is putting on it at some point in time if it has an economic approach. So I'm kind of curious as if there should be some mechanism whereby it isn't the first come, first serve basis, but that it is either on a lottery basis the first time around here, or if it's put forth on some way to where everybody has equal opportunity to be involved in it if this passes. That's all. Everybody that has a $25,000 bill in the back pocket. And they follow all the other criteria. I guess I have a problem because I see like it's a little bit like the stampede. I remember the land rush, you know, in Oklahoma. Everybody's at the line and we're all getting ready to go. And I don't know if that's going to happen with this. But there is a tremendous amount of interest, as we know. So just an observation. I don't have an answer to that. I just
curious how it works. Certainly that's, you know, a valid issue. I think because of the requirements that we have levied in this piece of legislation, because of the amount of the license fee, the amount of the bond that's a cash bond, the amount of each table of $10,000 on an annual basis, Representative Holm could be right. There may be a flood of people that are applying for these licenses, but I don't believe that's going to be the case. And I think a lot of what's going to happen with this is going to be market-driven as well. As far as if you had an opportunity for three card rooms in Fairbanks, and the first licensee that's awarded the opportunity to open one of these facilities then posts a $3 million fee for the tables, he's got a lot of tables in there. And the next person that may want to come and apply, I mean, again, it's based on this population-driven aspect that you have to have a certain number of card players out there. And you're estimating within the population of 30,000, there's enough to support a card room with 10 or 15 tables. If somebody comes in there with 60 tables, as a potential business owner myself, I'm not so sure I would want to risk the $25,000 that I'm not going to get back, and rightfully so, because it's probably going to cover a large portion of the costs to investigate me to see if I'm legitimate or not. But if I can't make profit, then that's a hefty amount of investment that you're making initially. So I think a lot of it's going to be market driven based on who really enters that market initially and what they can afford to put up as far as cash for the number of tables that they anticipate having in the facility.
Well, thank you very much.
Yep. Thank you, Representative Holm. Okay, let's go ahead, if there's no more questions, go to the amendments that Representative Weirach has prepared. Representative Weirach?
You have the amendments?
Yes, please.
I move Amendment 1.
Okay, object. We'll discuss.
It says the applicant has to list their attorney, and I just put if any. I hate to force somebody to think they have to hire an attorney. Why not an accountant too, right? Just, if they want an attorney, they can hire.
You are an attorney, right?
I don't think you should force anyone to get an attorney.
Very good. All right, I remove my objections. Any objections? Seeing none, that's adopted. Amendment number 1 is adopted.
Move Amendment 2.
Jeff?
It deletes on the business date. What this does is notice is served by certified mail and it's considered complete 3 business days following the date of the mailing. It just gives the person who gets the mail time for the process of mail, but gives them a little more time. And in general, in the process, you never consider it complete until 3 business days. It's just, I think, more equitable because you can mail it on a Thursday, it could be a holiday on Friday, you got Friday and Saturday, they may be out Monday because of a long weekend, they get it on Tuesday, then boom, you've got all those days gone. So I just think it's a fair time frame. That's all I did. It's pretty minor.
No objection. I'm surprised the 4 attorneys in the judiciary didn't catch that.
That one passed it, huh? Okay, Albert,
you have my objection.
Any other objections to Amendment 2? Then Amendment 2 is adopted.
And Mr. Chairman, I just had a question for the department on the sales tax issue I had. Other than that, I think there's more that can be done with this bill. I'm not going to do it anymore.
Okay, very good. Let's see. Mr. Myers with the tax division, who's on
well,
the line?
Well, whoever. It was just
from the Department of Revenue.
It just went to the question of when on page 2, under 3 wagers, the tokens and chips used to made are purchased from the owner of the card room. While the purchaser is in the card room or a facility that is adjacent to the card room and has been approved by the department. I just wondered where the taxable event is there. If you're in a municipality with a sales tax, how does a municipality obtain any revenue from this card room operation? Okay. Other than the sale of goods, like beer, wine, and chips.
Is that a question for Mr. Myers or revenue? Who wants to take, maybe some too anxious? Mr. Breed, do you want to take a shot at that?
And Mr. Myers, are you online this morning?
Mr. Chairman, yes, I am.
Okay. Well, we'll see how Mr. Freed does here, and then if you can help, just feel free to chime in.
For the record, my name is Brett Freed. I'm an economist with the Department of Revenue. Through the chair, Representative Weirach. I'm not familiar with all the different sort of municipal ordinances in the state. I mean, just, you know, but my guess would be that it would be based on, you know, what the fee that the house was charging each player for playing, that would be the taxable amount. But I can't say that for sure. Larry, do you have a better...
Mr. Chairman, I think it would be up to the local municipalities to determine whether they wanted to tax this particular activity. And how they would go about it, I think it would still be at their discretion.
So the question is if a card room takes money in exchange for tokens and chips, could a municipality rule that that is a taxable event, even though they can take those tokens and chips and later cash them in?
Through the chair, you know, that's a good question. You know, I do know that, you know, we've addressed it, or the municipalities have addressed it in the pull tab arena, where they turn around and they buy pull tabs and they tax them at that point, and they can turn around and receive winnings. You know, I'm not that familiar with each community.
Did you follow up?
On that point, if I recall on the pull tab thing, one of the difficulties we had when we were trying to tax the pull tab is each individual action or movement of chip from point A to point B does not mean there's a transfer of money at any given point in time. The size of the pot never changes. I could pass the pot to him, to you, to whatever, but there isn't any earnings made by anybody, so it's not a taxable event. And that's what the difficulty is with the pull tab. It's exactly the same thing. You're not increasing the amount of money. What you're doing is you're passing it from hand to hand to hand in this kind of an environment. So it really is it's a little different. You might tax the whole pot, or you might tax the whole, when somebody buys in, you probably could tax. But you can't tax the passing from one to another. Does that make sense?
Go ahead. Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, I'm just trying to, you know, the pull tabs are taxed as a sales tax.
But they tax pull tabs on the boat, on the whole, you know, the whole roll, as I understand it. Uh-huh. And they tax it once. And then however many times they pass those pull tabs around, doesn't matter.
Okay, Richard Hawkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Sharing my experience and having spent a fair amount of time in sales tax ordinances last session. My belief is, and understanding and experience in that, from that process. I'm not a lawyer, I'm not qualified to render a legal opinion by any means, but the sales taxation of gaming activities is a specialized area within the whole body of sales tax policies and procedures that the municipality would themselves choose. What you typically see, and at least in the experience I had looking at sales taxation of gaming activities, is that there's generally a specific exclusion, just to make it clear, that when you're simply exchanging money for a token, that the token represents the money in the game, that you specifically exclude that as by statute or by municipal ordinance, and say that that's just an exchange, it's just going to the money exchange, but you're exchanging currency. You're going to be here, you're going to exchange money for euros. But that typically the rules that we were looking at provided that if there was a premium charge on that service, and that was a service fee, and the municipality chose to sales tax services as well as the exchange of goods, that the service fee would be subject to sales taxation, but not the exchange of money for a token of equal value. So it all falls back into the local sales tax world.
Mr. Chairman, I guess the main point I want to get at is there's nothing in this bill that governs what a municipality may or may not do with respect to its tax policies, and it's open.
Okay. And I guess in some ways we may want to leave it open.
I think that's my preference.
Okay. Okay. Any other questions? Mr. Myers, Mr. Freed, the sponsor.
On the bond itself, do I remember that that's a cash bond? Is that a cash bond that's required?
Sponsor safe credit. Yes.
That's a $500,000 cash bond. Okay, if it is a cash bond, I don't remember what it is now.
I think we better have the sponsor come back to get this on record.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Freed.
Where is the cash bond going to be held? Who earns the interest on the cash bond? Is that determined by the state? Is that what happens to that cash bond?
It is held by the state.
And then the state earns the interest off of that?
The state would earn the interest off of it.
Okay, I just wanted that on the record. Okay, thank you.
Okay, very good. Where's that, Kelly?
Just a question. My position on this is probably going to offend two former speakers. One are... our friend here, and then the other would be a former speaker, my wife's grandfather, who ran the card room in Fairbanks for about 30 years, I think. But the municipality, Representative Cott, they can opt out by their action, but unless they currently have something preventing it on the books they're in, how does that work?
Take Fairbanks.
That would be correct, okay. What you said.
So they could take an action to not participate, even though they had the 30,000 requirement. And the second comment, Mr. Chairman, would be: is this if this goes ahead, is it something of value enough that it ought to be like an oil lease sale or something? I mean, if there's only one in Fairbanks, I can name some names. They're going to line up. Representative Cott at the gate, you know. And so, if everybody puts in 25, then they get it back. Based on, you know, they don't get in, so they get it back. If they don't win, they get it back, is what I heard. And think. So what about trying to make some, I mean, is there a chance that a premium ought to enter into the picture so that instead of throwing on this five-person board a big problem, because let's say everybody qualifies, then it's a rush to get to the office and that sort of thing. I'm just thinking there's a better way to do this. So that maybe instead of just not knowing how, not giving the board any direction on this, that maybe there's a way to do it where the state could actually put a little more value on this, do it that way, kind of a high bid approach or some other way.
Mr. Chairman, I think there's, you know, I mentioned, you know, it's first in, first out, but certainly there are provisions in the bill that are going to require the state to look at the best proposals, if you will. I mean, there's some legitimacy in filing that particular application, and the state will have to make up in their mind the best determination that they can based on what information they have available, that the applicant meets a number of the qualifications that are identified. So there may be a better mousetrap out there. I'm not sure how you can get to it.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kelly. Any other questions? Discussion?
And you didn't offend me.
Okay. Representative Foster?
I'll go ahead and move out. The finance issues have a full amendment.
Yes.
But individual expectations.
Did you want to object, Mr. Kelly?
Please.
Okay.
Madam Secretary.
Representative Hoyerock?
Yes.
Representative Foster?
Yes.
Representative Parker?
Yes, ma'am.
Representative Holm?
Yes.
Representative Kelly?
Mr. Chairman, I will vote yes so that this moves out of committee. I will do my individual recommendations. I think we have a quorum problem otherwise, so I won't stop it from moving out of committee. So I withdraw my objection.
Okay. Objection is removed. Bill moves out of committee.
Thank you.
Okay. Let's see. We got one more here for Representative Cott. While you're here, let's go ahead and knock it off.
So let's take, we have a resolution to extend the passport.
Let's take a brief edit.
Let's put the 100,000 bucks.
Oh, I'm sorry. We're back online. We're back. Let's go ahead. We'll do the resolution this afternoon, and as well as this other bill that we have here. I do want to make some modifications, so we'll carry these two bills over. We'll go ahead and take up House Bill 167. Senate Bill 147, I think that's a companion of Representative Holmes. Is that correct?
Yes.
Does Representative Holmes want to hear that?
Yes, we do.
Okay, and if it's a House bill, we'll go ahead and hear that. And then also, we have House Bill 148, Representative Cartulas, who's asked for a waiver, and I've asked that we hear it. It's called Trafficking in Persons. So we'll hear those House bills. We won't hear any Senate bills this afternoon. And what I'd like to do then is conclude fairly early so that we can go to work on that work committee, Senate Bill 141.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yep, and I know Representative Holmes asked to join your committee, and I think that's fine. In fact, anybody who wants to join, I'm sure you're welcome. I just want to keep the group fairly small so you guys could make some progress and try to find some common ground that you could bring forward on Saturday.
We've notified all the players, including Representative Holm, about 3:30.
Okay. Well, and my hope is that we'll adjourn prior to 3:30.
What was that notification?
About the subcommittee.
Okay. I've not been notified.
Okay. It was just we recognized that Representative Meyer was going to stop the full finance at 3:30, so it's probably back at your shop.
Okay, thank you.
And actually, my hope is maybe we can even stop prior to 3:30,
okay.
3 o'clock, and give you guys a little extra time.
Thank you.
And it's a work committee, not a subcommittee.
I understand.
That's fine. Okay, anything else?
What does that mean for the public record? You are still in control of the bill, and it is not those of us on the subcommittee who are in control of possession of the bill.
The Finance Committee is in charge of the, or in control of the
bill. There's been some confusion in public, and I think it's real important to know that the bill's co-chair of finance is still in possession of this bill.
That is correct.
Thank you.
Okay, anything else? Not, we're adjourned until this afternoon. 1:03.